This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Better off trying to create the demand and have people search for your brand and own that rather than try to pick up the generic into things, into assets that depreciate value. I should be dropping my money into things that I consume and need. And to me, that's the difference, right? Delivering a product that works and a business that's going to scale and then walking away from it.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 31. And it is going all different from this week. We got 31 episodes in before we realized that this shit would be so much easier if we don't do the spin cycle and the interview in the same episode. So if you've tuned in for an episode of the spin cycle this week, and if you have, God knows who you are because nobody else is, there is no spin cycle this week. So prepare to be very disappointed. What we're going to do from now on in is we are going to put the spin cycles as their own episodes for two reasons. Number one, getting Eddie and Patrick and Kim and anybody else involved is like herding dyslexic cats. So frankly, we can only do that once a month now because it's just, you know, killing us all. So we're going to try and do this once a month, but the second thing that means is that we're going to try and do them a little bit longer, a little bit more in depth, and perhaps incorporate Kim in more frequently, all those kind of things. So the spin cycle will get their own episodes, which means these episodes are just going to be our interviews, long form interviews with our special guests. And this week we have a gentleman by the name of Gerard Doyle, who is best described as a startup guru. He runs a company now called Fractal, where he spends most of his time helping startups, gain traction. The first part of a startup. So he's helping them sort of find their unique business propositions, find the appropriate audiences, those kind of things. So he's had a huge experience in startups, in all sorts of different businesses, but he also has a background in marketing and ad agencies and digital agencies and those kind of things. Really interesting background, really interesting story, well worth listening to Gerard, and then afterwards trying to touch base with him and catch up with him on LinkedIn if you want to. Talking of LinkedIn, please come and add me if you find me. I am Simon Dell on LinkedIn, and by that I mean the name is the URL is I am Simon Dell. My website is www.simondell.com. If you're looking for any kind of digital marketing solutions, myself and Matt, who run that, would love to talk to you no matter where in the world you are. We have clients in Sydney, we have clients in Queensland and Brisbane, which is where we are, and we have clients in the US and clients in the UK. So please come and talk to us. Digital marketing is something that you can cross borders with, so we'd love to talk to you about that. Also, the podcast boss, Gilberto, is still hacking away at finding new clients who want to record podcasts. So if you're interested in doing that, please go and check out the podcast boss, and all these links will be in the show notes. Last two things, our Instagram page, The Simon Dell Show, come and talk to that. Come and follow us on that. And the last thing is, what was the last thing? Oh yeah, rate and review us on iTunes. So it would be great if you could give us an opinion about what you thought of the show on iTunes. That would be fantastic. So without further ado, we will get on with the interview with Gerard. Joining me on the Simon Dell Show this week is Gerard Doyle, also from Brisbane, who is currently the CEO or founder and consult. What exactly are you? What's your job title, Gerard, at Fractal?
I would never call myself CEO. I have I hate people of a company of one who call themselves CEO of what? Chief Executive Officer of myself.
Yeah, fuck, I hate that as well. Anyway, so Gerard is the
founder
and boss of a company called Fractal, which is dedicated to helping startups find their unique business proposition, helping innovators and creators and dreamers find their market, he said, reading from directly from LinkedIn. So welcome to the show, Gerard Doyle.
Thanks for having me, Simon.
We are going to start off with my first question, which is normally what was the first job that you ever did and ever got paid for? However, one thing I do have to point out that to everybody on this show is that, and I am going to go completely off on a tangent here, Gerard, so I apologize about that completely, is that when I share the link to the software that we use to record the show, it creates a short link. For those of you who don't know what a short link is, you've probably been living under a rock for, you know, the past 10 years. And Cast, which is the software that we use, creates a Cast link, which is tricast/guest/6 numbers or letters. And those 6 numbers and letters are completely unique every time, so that every podcast has its own unique link. This week,
I just saw that,
first time ever, and I wondered whether you'd noticed it, it decided to put the short link was 9XMOFO. So Cast, Gerard, has already formed an opinion of you.
Do you know, and I was even looking
before
at software,
we started this.
I've been hurt. That's it. I recommended it to someone recently without even using it. That's it. They're off the list now.
I am going to screenshot this later on because I think that's hilarious that it could accidentally call you a mofo. But anyway, so back to the original first question, which was, what was your first job that you actually got paid for?
Oh, look, first job I got paid for is boring. That's just a paper boy riding around on my bike, delivering the Brisbane news, throwing it on people's driveways. That's not the interesting one. I think the more interesting one was the next check I got was actually doing internet marketing back in about 95. I didn't even know what it was, but I was doing I built an online website that really spoke up to the pay to surf industry. And if anyone's old enough to remember, that was when we had banners that would run on your browser and you'd earn a commission on how many banners were showing.
So I had one of those.
It was like there was All Advantage and all these different companies that all went bust. They're all pyramid schemes at the end of the day. But, you know, as a 17-year-old, I built this site and became sort of an authority in Australia on it. And, got my second check, not the paper boy one, that's boring, but my first business check was actually in US dollars. And when it cleared, I couldn't believe it.
How much was it for?
It was about 70, 80 US dollars, which would have been 150 bucks, which, you know, back in the days where there were dollar drinks when you went out, that's a lot of rum and cokes at Rosie's.
How old were you at the time?
If you ask Rosie's, I was 18. But I think I was a mature looking 17-year-old.
That's what the ID said.
Anyway. Exactly. That's a whole other business thing I'm not going to get into because I'll put myself in jail.
We've had some various suspect confessions on this show about pasts and things like that. So I think the federal police have got much more interest in people to track down than you on this.
Hopefully.
What was the website that you put the ads on?
So I ran a website called cashgenerators.net. Which is hilarious because back in the day there were so many .coms available, but for some reason I went with .net. And I basically, it was really weird. It was I SEO'd it to the top of Excite and Yahoo and LookSmart and AltaVista because it predated Google. And then I started buying paid search traffic and amazingly kind of learned pay-per-click marketing back in 96 when, you know, this just didn't exist. It was so new. And I was buying like Get Rich Quick at the top of, you know, Yahoo, which was being run by GoTo, which became Overture, which then became Yahoo. Eventually they bought the whole thing. But, you know, just a kid with his own, you know, personal Commonwealth Bank credit card and doing that and making it work, really. Built a mailing list and sort of went from there.
Did you keep doing it, or was it just that one check and you got so drunk at Rosie's that you gave up the whole job?
I think the biggest check I got was about 1500, 1700 US dollars from a bunch of them. The pinnacle was actually I got a phone call from the Australian newspaper, of all things, who sort of rang up and rang my home phone number because that's what was there. My dad answered it. He was sure I was in trouble. And then amazingly, they ran an article featuring me as like an international expert And I just couldn't believe it. And then, of course, a whole bunch of people signed up off the back of that. Then Australian Personal Computer Magazine picked it up. And you kind of, I was at uni doing business and I had no real idea that even earning those checks, I still went and applied for internships at BHP and, you know, right. banks. And then one awesome recruiter just sort of looked and went, hang on, you can just do this internet thing as a job, you know. Really? Is this? Yeah. And then that was sort of the start of everything. But it's amazing. You can be making money, running your own business, and then you still fall into the standard, oh, well, I'm graduating my business degree from UQ now. I've got to go off and work for a mining company. That's what you do, right?
Your dad wasn't suspect. Your dad wasn't suspect in big checks arriving like once a month or anything like that.
Totally suspect. He walked down with me when I banked the first one over $1,000. He came with me because he thought he might have to bail me out. Like he thought something was going to get wrong. And then he laughed and went, "Well, it'll never clear." And then it cleared. And then you get to the same. What are you doing? Because I think he had this idea in his head that I was just sitting in his office playing computer games. But in actual fact, I was dialing into like a 14.4K modem. You know, that thing that, older internet veterans, you know, you can play that noise and I won't try to do it with my voice now, but, you know, it kind of brings back memories of the day. And I was playing some games, but you kind of didn't realize I was building a real thing. And then it just took an employer, you know, a founder of a company to kind of look and go, actually, there's very few people around here who can do SEO, build websites, run paid search. I mean, it didn't exist. Got a lucky first job and then an even better second job working at Dark Blue Sea in Brisbane, which was, at the time, it was really the pinnacle of internet working in Brisbane. There was, our peak, we had about 110, and I'll call us all kids, just working for, we ran affiliate networks, we ran online games, trading games, we ran paid search engines. If we could think of it, we were getting back to build it. So it was exciting times.
That was all sort of basic HTML as well back then, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I built was with, do you remember Sausage Software? And they had whatever their software was.
That sounds really dodgy, Joe, but keep going.
there was a darling internet Australian company that created a WYSIWYG HTML editor, and it was called Sausage Software, and it raised a truckload of money in the late 90s. So during the US.com boom, it was one of the few Australian companies. Okay. And I used that. So it was
I used Dreamweaver. That was about as kind of Dreamweaver and Fireworks and all that macro. I can't even remember who owned them. Was it Macromedia or?
Yeah, I think it was Macromedia, and then it became Adobe. I had that as well. But you know, and at the risk of making this entire podcast about things that I've done that don't completely follow the law, I don't think I owned a completely registered copy of Dreamweaver.
Oh man, nobody did. You know, you were always that you could. That back in those days, you could. You could find the keys online, couldn't you? You could find generated keys for Dreamweaver and all those kind of things. And you'd put them in and the software would work.
Yeah.
It didn't work one day. And then you'd find another key and, you know.
Yeah. And then you realize that like Netscape's got something built into, you know, communicate or whatever it is. You just find the cheap free alternative and you sort of go from there. Yeah. So yeah, it pays testimony to the idea that trying to charge students and everybody money for your product isn't always the best approach. Sometimes the best approach is to become embedded, become a standard, and then charge the enterprise level. And you're going to probably make more money for a longer period of time rather than chasing around, you know, impoverished students all the time. So,
I think back in some of those pieces of software, I mean, that was back in the sort of Napster days as well, like when you could download whatever the fuck you liked off the internet, really. And, you know, and I was just downloading, I had like 20 MP3s downloading at any given time. And
I remember working with Napster, and I was kind of like, I kind of pioneered this idea of what they do, you know, they seed up fake videos now and they put fake songs on. And one day I worked out that, I could optimize a song, a track to get at the top and it become really popular. And one night having a few drinks, I recorded my own voice and got the track length to the exact one of the latest song, put it up there. And I sort of woke up the next morning and realized I'd had tens of thousands of downloads of me singing whatever song it was just to see if I could get away with it. And I did. And I thought, that's actually a bit of an issue. So I guess technically I had a short career as a, as a musician. But
I was going to say, if you counted those downloads today in the ARIA chart, you'd probably chart somewhere.
And the whole reason I did it was to trick my wife so that I could put it onto a CD and put it into her car because she was driving a long way.
Right.
And so I would burn CDs for her, so for her travels. And then about track 7, I just introduced a song where I sang the entire thing, which I thought was funny, and then ended up becoming an overnight Napster sensation.
An unknown internet sensation, because obviously I guess you didn't tell everybody who you were you were just singing it.
Yeah, it was, and really badly too. So
that's a shame. You could have become famous.
Oh, look, all these starts of businesses. Then. Yeah, all these things that I've sort of started and never followed through on.
Do you have that sort of entrepreneurial ADD where you start things and don't finish them?
I used to say that, and then I met a few people that describe themselves in the same way, and it used to frustrate me, and I couldn't work out why. When they said it, it frustrated me, but I felt like it was a reason for me. And as I've matured, I've decided that it's not that I don't have trouble finishing things. What I tend to not get pleasure out of is exploiting something to the nth degree. So what I mean by that is, once I've solved the business problem, once I go, oh, I've got it, I've built it, it's done, it works, I don't tend to then keep pushing all the way through and get a huge amount of money from it. Whereas I met other people who sort of, their version of it was, oh, I come up with a good idea, but they don't actually deliver the product. They don't actually make it work and test it. It's just an idea in their head. And the third type of people are the ones who sort of see that idea and go, oh, I'm going to build that, and then I'm going to make a whole lot of money. And I think of like search engine marketing as being, and like I've had a great career as a search engine marketer for the last 20 years, but you know, there's people that even in the last 4 or 5 years have spun up search agencies in Australia and still exited and made millions. And I always look and go, well, I still could do that, but I don't get no pleasure. I get no pleasure from that. I kind of know that I've done it, so I don't kind of follow through and make the big money, which is, you know, every now and then I stop and think maybe, oh yeah, that's assuming that I could, of course. But I think serial entrepreneurs who are successful are the ones who come up with an idea, prove that it works, solve it, create the business, and then they go, well, now that I've done the tricky bit, I'm not going to sit here and build a big company and make a lot of money and see the numbers roll in. I'm quite happy to go to the next idea. And to me, that's the difference, right? Delivering a product that works and a business that's going to scale and then walking away from it, that's totally different from somebody who goes, oh, I've got an idea for a faster car or a better mousetrap, and then they just leave it. That doesn't count. You got to have the hustle to solve the problem.
One of my favorite quotes is, and I can't remember who it's from, and I will have to look it up one day, is the quote is, the best way to make a fortune is to have a really, really good idea and then never, ever have another one.
Yeah.
And I love that, because I go, that to me is if you are going to make a fortune, you do have to follow these. I think you still have to follow these things through to the end. I think, I understand your point about jumping from, creating something and then allowing someone else to scale it. It's interesting. I think that the entrepreneurial ADD that I talk about with a friend of mine is sometimes damaging, because when you're in the middle of doing one thing, all of a sudden you go, oh, look, there's a dog, and you go running off like you were Homer Simpson and get distracted from actually completing the first thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's why I think in the startup industry and working with founders, that one of the questions that good investors often ask is, do you want to be in this industry for 10 years? Because what happens is, after the fun and, you've kind of discovered the business, once that bit's going, you've got to run this business and grow this and then exit the business. And so there might be 5 years of up and fun and experimentation, but there's also going to be 5 years of corporate style grind if you are successful to get that proper exit. And, from an investor's point of view, the last thing they want is someone like, the entrepreneurial ADD, because that just means they're going to have almost a great investment and then it's going to disappear on them. So, no, exactly. And I think that's why, you want to pick an industry that you would work in anyway, whenever it happens to be. So the way I solved that for me was to not be another founder of a startup company and become an agency or a consultant to startups. So all I do is get the fun of helping founders with their new ideas.
Yeah, the easy bit. Yeah.
Yeah, without necessarily the same amount of risk, but it allows me to satisfy that ADD of different ideas. So I can work with 10, 11, 12 different founders at any one point in time. And that's been my solution to that problem. So I hope it works.
Well, we'll sort of come on to that later on. I want to touch on a couple of things so earlier in your career. As you mentioned, you've got a background in internet marketing. Sounds such an old, that's an old expression. Now, digital marketing, let's call it digital marketing. And especially, looking at your history, lots of search engine optimization, lots of pay per click, and all those kind of things. How important is that? Let's take them separately. How important is search engine optimization today to the average business and, the average small business?
Look, it's not what it was. It's important that you own your brand. I think too many businesses all chase the one holy grail of ranking number one for the generic term that they want to chase. And search is sort of a winner takes all. So I feel for most brands, you're better off trying to create the demand and have people search for your brand and own that rather than try to pick up the generic. I also know that the generic search terms tend to have more fickle visitors. The customers are a bit more likely to be price sensitive and less brand loyal. But for me, look, this is the evolution of search. The first evolution of search was very much about on-page keyword density. So when I said back in 96, when I was optimizing, it was just about, keyword stuffing and hiding text with white backgrounds white text on a white background, that kind of stuff. And then Google came along, and Google's big change was they valued links, and links were votes. And that was a bit different, but we could still game that. The third evolution that we're currently in with search is very much around the user experience and the vote. The people's experience of your website and how they find it and other sources of traffic, not just links. And that means that it's much harder to game it. So with founders, I'm almost always saying SEO is a long-term game. This isn't something you want to be getting into now. In fact, you're better off just doing paid search, seeing if it works, and then worrying about if you want to start a 6 to 12 month SEO campaign. The illusion of free traffic for SEO is
you get a lot of people saying, the challenge I find is that a lot of people, want you to do SEO, and then, one of the things I push back on them and say, well, look, there's a content play here as well. You need to be producing good quality content as well. And not just producing good quality content, but amplifying that content. So you need people reading your blogs, you need people watching your videos and all those kind of things. That suddenly becomes a really hard ask for a small business who's got maybe, $1,000, $2,000 budget every month.
And that's, there's always going to be middlemen who sit in there and can beat them. There's always going to be the aggregator and the comparison site that's probably going to do better, or the restaurant review site, or whatever it happens to be. So you just look at these small businesses and go, don't worry about it. Create a good user experience, give what you need, but I think SEO for small businesses, there's a lot of agencies out there doing it, charging those basic retainer packages, but very rarely does it make sense for these guys. Like you said, they're much better off focusing on something they've got more control over. And as the world grows up, there's always going to be some site, and it's usually Google, but there's always some site that'll sit in between. And you're much better off just playing the game and going, look, do I build up my B&B to rank on a particular search engine, or just put it on Airbnb and they own that space. And you just accept, that you're just not going to have that. You haven't got that same kind of scale, so you're not going to win that game.
What about the voice element of search that you think? Do you think that's going to become I know if you read any tech magazine or any tech website or whatever, that everyone says voice for the next 5 years, 10 years, whatever. What's your feeling on it?
I think voice is, I was just talking to someone yesterday. I said, I think that's the next 5-year horizon. I think what we're facing is we've gone from text, voice sort of started, videos become bigger, but the problem with videos, it's an all encompassing medium. Whereas what we're doing right now. Okay, so most people who are listening to this are probably doing something else. They're either walking the dog, they're mowing the lawn, probably not mowing the lawn, they're driving their car, they're sitting at work.
I should hope they're not doing anything, Jared. I hope they're sitting there actually paying the fucking attention. That's what I hope, but no, you're right. You're right, they're doing something else, yeah.
And that dual tasking, that's the change, right? So yeah, that you're sitting on a bus right now and you're listening to a podcast, this is how you're, you know, consuming content. Yet all the amazing nuggets of information that we're about to share over the next, you know, 10, 15 minutes are lost to most of the search engines because they're not indexing this and they're not putting it there. So I always, well, back in the 90s and early noughties where I was building sort of search engines and optimizing, I used to always run the basic question, which was, what would I do if I was Google? If I was Google, I would be working how to get this information out of audio really quickly, because if someone else beats them to that, then all the information that we're sharing here, every podcast, if there's another search engine can pull that information up, that's going to be the win. Yeah. So, and then conversely, you know, it's from a business point of view, it's entirely different. So we're not playing a scale game now. You know, you might have a few hundred people, maybe 1,000 people who listen to this episode, maybe it's 5,000 a few years time or whatever it happens to be, but it's, the engagement here is entirely different as well. You know, half an hour of, you know, you and I talking is a much deeper and more personal experience than a bit of text on a page that you can click back off of. So, look, I think investing in content that lasts forever will pay off in the long term. You know, fleeting engagements sort of, you know, are exactly that. They come and go. But if you put content out there and voice, I think is a great place to be. And if it aligns with your business objectives, it lasts forever. It pays back. So you're building an asset base of marketing content that'll keep paying back to you. So look, I'm a massive fan of voice. I think it's probably got, like I said, that next 5 years, it's going to really become a big deal. And then, you know, with the increase of Siri and Google Homes and whatnot, you know, it's going to be there. That's what's going to happen.
The two challenges I have with voice search is number one, having something in my house that's constantly listening to me. And as my wife continually points out, I already have that with a phone, but let's digress. So that's challenge number one. The second one, and I use an exact example, is when I try to explain to Siri the word Indooroopilly, which is the suburb I live in Brisbane. And what Siri hears is gibberish, and I'm going, how does more sophisticated search solve that problem that it frustrates me so much that eventually I just go, fuck it, I'll work it out when I get home, or, you know, whatever. And I abandon the whole concept of search because Siri can't pick up certain words. Those are my two big challenges. And I'm sure AI is going to solve one of them. But the privacy element, I don't know.
I think privacy. I think that's the secondary consideration. Look, I just believe in the evolution of technology. And I think back to, you know, we'll go back to the 90s again, you know, text search was horrible. It was really hard to find what you wanted. There was all sorts of things and tricks you had to do to find what you wanted. You'd go to directories because they were curated and they'd work better. It'll get there. It will just happen. They will eventually get it to work, and you will be able to say anything in an Australian accent, and you can have crazy places like, you know, Indooroopilly and Capalabar and all the Australian locations. But they will work it out. And it will be a better experience. It's not quite in that mass adoption phase. And I think for most people, most people live their lives, you know, as sort of late majority, early majority adopters on that adoption of innovation curve. And as technologists, we're often at the front end of it. So I'm comfortable with things that don't quite work, because that's what I'm comfortable operating at the pointy edge of that adoption curve. Most people aren't. And so they're experiencing Siri and Alexa and Google Home and getting increasingly frustrated, because normally these products don't hit the market until they're consumer friendly. They're not normally seeing it. And I think what's interesting about all these HomePods is that these tech companies have pushed people to become earlier adopters of technology than they're normally used to. Normally this stuff is tested. And that's because, you know, they're an innovative company. They're used to rolling stuff out pretty quickly and just letting it go. And so I think that's the pushback for most people, is that it seems like a mass consumer product, but it's not finished yet. It's still in beta. So I've got friends, the same thing. They go, oh, it doesn't work. This is terrible. And they get frustrated with it. And for me, I just go, well, yeah, it doesn't, but it'll get there. And to me, that's what an early adopter is, someone who's willing to take the bugs and the quips, because you look and you go, but when it does work, this is going to be great.
The interesting thing is that the only thing that's funnier than listening to Siri try and handle the word Indooroopilly is listening to my mother try and do it. But that's, I digress. I wonder whether that idea about, getting beta versions of things out there is where we're going to go with things like, autonomous vehicles. I think the challenge obviously there is
I hope not. Yeah. There's a bigger cost if they
absolutely
get that one wrong.
You can't really have a beta version of, well, yeah, I mean, the argument would be is that there are beta versions of autonomous vehicles out there at the moment, and they're called Teslas. And people are trying to use them like their level 4, level 5 vehicles. But
I learned that the other day. I listened to one of your previous podcasts, yeah, and I learned about the levels, and I'm just purchasing my a new car, and it's just a Mazda, and you think, oh, it's a Mazda or something. And I was explaining to the Mazda dealer about all these levels of autonomy, and literally quoting you back to the dealer, and saying, look, this counts because it when I drive this new car, it reads the road signs and it'll flash it up on the dash. And I said, well, that's like level 0. I said, but I'm getting the extra feature that if the car in front is stopped and we're going to hit it and I'm braking but not hard enough, it'll take over and brake for me. And so I said, that's level 1 or whatever it was. I've totally got it wrong. But the salesman was totally taken by it. I spoke to him yesterday. He said, oh, I'm telling everybody about that thing you told me. I thought, oh, gee, I hope I got it right.
Well, I hope Simon got it right and he's not feeding me, I can't even remember where I read it off, but I'm sure I read it off of the authoritative website. I mean, that's the whole argument of me getting into autonomous cars, and I shan't, repeat it again, was that I felt that in 3 years' time, a secondhand non-autonomous car is going to be so devalued that it's going to be close to worthless. Because anyone who's going to want to be buying a car in 3 years' time is going to be wanting to look for a level 4 or level 5 car, or is going to be wanting to move on to a subscription service that has, let's say, 50 households on it and a pool of, 75, 80 cars. That to me is where, we move to next. And that's why I keep saying to people, if you're going to buy a car now, have a real think about it, because it could be worthless in 3 years' time. Whereas previously, 3 years' time, you'd expect cars to have a residual value. But
yeah. No, I said that to my wife when we were buying it. I said, this will be the last time we probably buy a petrol car that we have to control these things. So I was like, let's get that one with the turbo, because I've never had anything with a turbo in it. Because again, that's probably the last time I'm going to be able to do it.
Let's go really ostentatious, considering this might be the last car that we ever drive. So, all right, look, there's a couple of other bits and pieces I sort of want to talk to you about. And again, I think sort of from full disclosure in here, as I found out the other day, you and I happen to own shares in the same company, which I'm like, oh, there we go. That shows the research and due diligence that I did in the past. Zippy.com.au. Tell me how that started.
So it's a good one. So it was my attempt to get myself from Britain back to Brisbane. So living in London for 10 years, my daughter was born, I just exited a business and I needed to come back to Brisbane, but there were no jobs that I could really see or that I wanted to do. So if you can't find a job, you make a job. And so I decided to launch an Australian business from my Putney home in London. And it was Zippy. And Zippy originally was an insurance comparison business. Then I pivoted it into a coupon style business, which I'd been working on in the UK.
Yeah.
Then I pivoted that into a local rewards based company. By that stage, I was living in Brisbane. I'd moved and put everything into it.
Right.
So I went through a few evolutions, and it was that rewards based app tablet-y business that was the one that kind of became the evolution that moved up into BDS we raised money for, and is the version of the business that we jointly hold probably very few shares in collectively. Now it's a bit of a amalgamation of a bunch of businesses rolled up together now.
I was trying to work out that should all those convertible notes be cashed in, that exactly how much how many shares I would have. And I think it's
Don't do it.
Well, actually, it wasn't too bad. I think it's something like 5%. And I was like, could be, considering the evolution of the life cycle of what that went through. I'm like, I'm happy with that. So, there was one thing I was going to touch on there. All those pivots from an insurance comparison to a coupon business, what sort of drove those pivots? And were they kind of like overnight, like you woke up and go, right, fuck it, forget that, let's go and do that instead?
No, so each one's got its own story. So the pivot over insurance was driven by the fact, so I, being an SEO, paid search guy, I got Zippy to rank number one in Australia on Google for car insurance, number three for like home insurance and all these terms. And I was doing heaps of quotes, but I had to kind of hack the system. I even had an AFSL, like I was an authorized rep of an AFSL.
Right.
And then I got three tip-offs. The first tip-off came from a friend who was working at a law firm who sort of said, I think you need to be careful about this. The other tip. The next tip-off came from a guy I hadn't worked with a couple of times before who actually was building a comparison business himself. And he got taken to court by ASIC for breach of the General Insurance Act in Australia. And one of the great insurance companies, challenging insurance brands in Australia, actually paid his $50,000 fine and took his assets off him. But they pretty much, they paid out the fine just so he wouldn't go under. Yeah. And what I learned was that actually the two big general insurance groups in Australia, they don't need to fight. They simply hide behind, see, Australia has the largest General Insurance Act in the world. And so they just hide behind it. And every single general insurance company in Australia is in breach of it all the time because it's so complicated. You could never be 100% compliant. So all they do is throw lawyers at each other. Now, if you're a small startup business and you all of a sudden start ranking and disrupting an industry with their comparison side, they just throw the book at you. You can't afford, even though you're doing the right thing, you're just going to get taken down. And so I got that tip off both from that challenger insurance company, the founder of that, and my lawyer friend who just went, yeah, you're next in line, Jared. So I had to actually 404 the entire site. So I went from doing 400 to 600 quotes a day to zero and just lost the whole thing just because, the cost was going to be huge. So I've always had a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the way Australia sets up these regulations and laws in theory to protect people, but they become so bureaucratic. The only people who can actually comply to them have the money and are probably in a monopolistic or duopolistic position. And secondly, it just sort of goes to feed the beast. So, it sort of forced my hand really and then moved into vouchers, which is what I was doing in the UK. So I sort of said, I'll go into vouchers. I know that space inside out. We hit Australia. I brought my English co-founder over with me. And about 2 weeks after we were here, Maya sent us a cease and desist letter for three breaches, or two that I remember. One was using their logo. Wow. On our website, which we didn't actually do. It just so happens that Maya's logo is so inventive. It's just black text on a white background. So we responded to that. Two, they actually, this is in 2007, sent a cease and desist letter for linking to their website. And wow. I got that. And my business partner, who was British, had never moved to Australia. And I'd been gone for 10 years, just went, oh my God, this is, what is wrong with this country? Why, how is this a thing? How is someone not wanting a link? How is someone not wanting traffic? How are they sending you a cease and desist letter? Yeah. That's cost a fortune. We had to take it down. And it really showed me that they weren't ready, not only for online marketing and affiliate marketing, which is where we were going to monetize it, they weren't even ready for the internet. And so, when I think about where Maya is now, there's, as a company, like take the staff and people out, but as a company, I laugh. I love the fact they're struggling because I just go, do you know what? That's the bed you made. You actually paid your internal lawyers to send cease and desist letters to businesses who are linking to you, mentioning things like, hey, Maya's got a stock take sale on. And they go, well, you're portraying you've got some kind of relationship with us. And you think, well, gee, do you wonder why Maya finds themselves in the problem they're in when they were sending cease and desist letters to startup companies who ran small websites that, God forbid, linked to them and sent them visitors? So, as a corporation, I just go, they're not going to be able to change that. that DNA was there in 2007, 2008. It ain't changing.
That's madness. That's, yeah. And you look at the business as it is now in 2018, and we've spoken about it many times on this podcast, that I don't know how Maya hangs on. You know, it's, we talk about potential mergers with David Jones and, you know, and all those kind of things, but you go into the store and you go, I'm having the same experience here that I was having when I was in the middle of the 80s in Alders, which was a British department store that, yeah, that sort of died a death back then. You know, where my grandma used to work. We used to go and see my grandma working in Alders, and I'm going, it just hasn't changed. And it's a shame that it hasn't changed, but, you know, but you're right. It's top down. If it's the management can't get that, then nobody will.
No, and it's, you know, one of my biggest annoyances of businesses that they get to a strong position and they defend it. So they have that typical sort of monopolistic defense where they go, oh, we're going to have restricted supply. So this is the Jerry Harvey approach to the world. I don't like the internet, so I'm just going to try to shut down the internet. Yeah. And you just go, well, that's another business that's just dead. Like, Harvey Norman is just going to die. It is a real estate-based business where they make money out of their franchisees and store owners.
Yeah.
You know, the actual consumer side and the financing. And he's looking at, well, it's a dead business. It's not going to continue. So he's just carrying on. And yet, you know, it takes another, you know, couple of years, and everyone look back and go, oh, what a surprise. Harvey Norman, you know, we always knew Harvey Norman was going to, you know, the stock market pickers aren't there. So I just think if you're in one of these, if your business is about restrictive supply, you're going to be pulled apart. Whereas you see the new behemoths coming through, so your Netflix, your Amazon, your Google, your Apple, they know what disruption is. They buy the disruption. They try to disrupt themselves because they're, and that's actually more scary in my mind. So, you know, the banks and their monopolistic position, supermarkets, the way they control a car, I'm less worried about those guys because they're not used to innovation. But someone like Google, who knows how to innovate, they might hang around for a little bit longer. You know, they've got that new style, which is, okay, we're not just going to be the dominant search player and just sort of screw everybody over with that position and then fight anybody who comes near us. We're going to try to innovate ourselves, which, look, is a more healthy business position to be in. But I think if you pick any business at the moment who's got a monopolistic position, they've got a whole lot of redundant, you know, costs built into their business, and the way they control is through restrictive supply, I'm not a fan of those businesses. I think most of them are going to struggle. So I'm loving the fact that Maya's where it's at. As a company, as a consumer, for the staff, etc., that's not a great thing.
No,
but you know, from a purely non-emotional business sense, yeah, you know, good riddance.
The interesting thing I think is that, you know, when you look at a Harvey Norman of this world, and you just say, next week I need to go and buy a washing machine. To me, I mean, I think I bought my last tumble dryer online from Appliances Online. And it was sort of delivered within 3 days, and, you know, they put it in, took all the packaging away, job done. Interestingly, that's probably the first piece of electrical equipment that I've purchased that I've not actually wanted to see before. The difference between that, when I'm sitting here using two pieces of equipment, aside from the laptop, but a Rode microphone and some Bose headphones, I had to see those. I had to touch them and visualize them first before I bought them.
Hmm.
Do you think that's still going to be a necessity sort of moving forward in the retail space?
Yeah, but it won't be the way it's set up at the moment. So at the moment you can go into stores and you compare things. And look, I'm the same as you. You know, I've got some Bose headphones and I went into VideoPro and VideoPro is fantastic. But those businesses, they're not flagships. So I think what's going to happen is if you go into a Westfield of the future, it will just be brand ambassador stores. So you go into Westfield now, you can go into Bose and you can try out Bose things. And you speak to the staff, they're not incentivized to sell you headphones and speakers. They're incentivized to give you a good experience.
Yeah.
And so that is what shopping centers of the future will be. They will be experiential experience centers where you walk in and you walk and say, let's go into the Nike shop. Let's go into Adidas. Let's go into Country Road or whatever it happens to, well, not Country Road, but any of these shops. And you go, I want to walk into a Microsoft store like in Sydney and I want to touch the Surface Pro and go, that's what I want. And then Microsoft don't care. You can buy it anywhere. And that, to me, that's what it is. And so the idea that a store can provide that service and then be undercut elsewhere, or, you know, the Harvey Norman example, you find, I sort of found exactly what I wanted to buy. And then they said, oh, well, we've got to organize a courier, which is a separate company, and you can't do this and you can't do that.
Yeah.
And we've got nothing in stock. And you go, well, if you don't have stock, what's your purpose? Like, I don't, you are a showroom of goods that other people give you. And really what you're trying to, what you're hoping like hell is that I'm going to pick up one of those GE money credit card things, and they're going to make a buck off that.
Two things that jump out to me there was when I bought a washing machine out of Harvey Norman, which was the last time I bought something from Harvey Norman. I had a conversation with the guy there, and we're looking at this long list of, I mean, there was 15 different makes and models there. And I said to him, you know what, like, which one? I've got, this is my budget. I said, what one would you buy? And he just pointed to one of them. And I said, why that one? He goes, oh, it's just better than all the others. He said, you know, for, you know, volume of water that it uses, blah, 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 all the features, he just said. And I said to him, well, if that one's so good, because he goes, it's kind of head and shoulders above all the others. And I said, if that one's so good, why do you bother selling all the others? And he looked at me and just shrugged his shoulders. Go, don't really know. He said, that's the one I recommend to everybody, you know, because it's just the best one. So you go, if Harvey Norman recognized that, which they do, I'm just thinking of the costs that they could save their franchisees by just cutting down the volume of brands and makes and models that they sold, and just sold the ones that were actually any good and fuck the rest of them off, you know. But of course they're not, because they're taking massive kickbacks and discounts and all these kind of things, and, you know, so on and so from all the others. And so that sort of irks me about Harvey Norman. But the second one, which I think you touched on there, was the Freedom Furniture one. I mean, you didn't touch on Freedom Furniture, but the idea of not having the thing in stock. When I bought the sofa that we have from Freedom Furniture, you went in there and go, right, we like this sofa. How, you know, and we can pay for it today, or we pay for it on instant free, you know, instant credit, whatever it is, free credit. Interest free, that's what I meant, not instant. And you say to them, how quickly can you get it to us? And they go, 12 weeks. And you go, what the fuck? You know,
it's not in the country.
It's not even
still going to come in from overseas.
Well, yeah. Do you know what? I say, they haven't even fucking made it. You know, the order will leave that Freedom Furniture, and it will go to, you know, China or Bangladesh or wherever it's being made, and someone will make that sofa tomorrow, and then they'll put it on. I'm going, how is that a good customer experience in any way, shape or form?
Yeah, and it's, I think, and they're suffering because everyone assumes that all these big furniture retailers have stock. They assume that they've got it somewhere in a warehouse, they've got to get it. And sometimes... I've had a bit of experience in the industry. Sometimes it's actually quicker to get it in from overseas than it is to move it inside Australia. If you're in Brisbane and there's a sofa in Adelaide, it's actually easier from just to get it in another one in from overseas than it is to try to get it out of Adelaide and up the
And then you look at something like a disruptor in that space, like Koala. I don't know if you've ever seen that. I mean, I am actually sitting at this moment on a Koala mattress. This is not a paid endorsement, I would like to point out. But I'm sitting on a Koala mattress, and they'd recently started doing sofas. And there's one sofa, it's one type. I think there's probably one color as well. But they'll have it to your house. You pay for it and order it. It's at your house in 4 hours, and you can put it together in 30 minutes. And you just go, that's a good customer experience.
Yeah, they win. And I love a company like that, you know. And it was that kind of logic that made me realize when I wanted to move back out of agency land. So, you know, I've worked, you know, three startups, but at the same time, I've also worked at, sort of created and built up three ad agencies. And in the last one, it was that exact logic where I went, I want to be working for the company like Koala that's disrupting and giving a better service and you know, creating market efficiencies. Yeah. I don't want to be working for the behemoth that's crushing them simply by putting more stores out and buying millions of dollars worth of ads. That doesn't excite me. I felt the way I describe it is it's like being an engineer. You know, what's the best project you can work on? And it's like the Death Star in Star Wars. And you go, it's fantastic. It's a mechanical engineering marvel. You've built an entire planet. But at the end of the day, it's a death machine. You just go, actually, I think I'm going to join the Rebel Alliance because, you know, yes, I don't get to fly around and build the Death Star, but actually I want to be on the side of good. Yeah. And to me, it's that clear, you know. I don't want to do great marketing for companies that just put out shitty products. Like that's why do I want to put, if I'm a great marketer, why do I want to support a company that delivers an inferior product or an inferior service? What I want to do is try to tell everybody about there's a better way to do this. And it's, you know, whatever it happens to be, it's delivered mattresses or sofas or just whatever it happens to be. If it's better and better for everybody, that's the marketing I want to do. So I think it's going to be an interesting time in retail, and we'll slowly go through that phase of everything speeding up. And then, like you said, that the next phase will be the idea that you don't need to own anything. The idea that everything you have could be leased and rented. And I think we'll just move further and further. And the concept now seems strange, but I think more and more things that we have will just become leased and rented to the point where if we can get people thinking around the ideas of, If I buy something, it has to be an asset. And if that asset doesn't produce income for me, then why am I buying it? It's not what I should be. I shouldn't be dropping my money into things, into assets that depreciate in value. I should be dropping my money into things that I consume and need. If I want to invest in property, I'll buy my investment house, but that's because I know it's going to give me a return. And so I think in every facet of our lives, we need to start looking at the things and how we spend our money and deciding, well, if I own that, does that give me a return? And if not, then I'm doing it purely for self-indulgent reasons. And so, you know, for me, that's the big opportunity moving forward, is so many things that we have can be leased or rented and shouldn't be owned outright. And I think, you know, savvy people are kind of owning an investment property and renting the house they live in for the flexibility.
Yeah. It brings it all the way back to the same, you know, back to autonomous cars again. Why would you, people own cars, it's for vanity, you know. Yeah. And if you could rent something that just turned up when you needed it, that's just such a much more attractive, you know, attractive proposition. So,
yeah, I my wife and I debated what we wanted to do, whether we want to get two cars because the kids are getting older. They're moving into, you know, weekend sports. And we just went, do you know what? For the rare occasion where there's an issue, we'll just get an Uber. And even if that Uber, it feels like an indulgence sort of thing to go, oh, we'll cut from soccer across to netball. And it's going to cost us $30 in an Uber. But that's nothing compared to the depreciation of a car every day. And yet we don't see that money. So somehow we tell ourselves that it's an asset. I think the mentality is completely wrong. And so, you know, for business owners, I think if you can think about areas where you can move a business from selling goods as assets and starting to lease and rent them and change the mentality of the people behind that, I think it's going to, I think there's business opportunities all over for that area.
Tell us a bit more about Fractal then. So what's the, you know, what's your sort of mission and how are you working with startups there?
Yeah. So my mission is, look, I've never considered myself a Queenslander, but the first time ever I sort of called myself a Queenslander was a year ago when we're talking about the startup system. And it's the one time I say I'm a Queenslander is when it comes to startups. I'm a Queensland startup guy. But for me, it was about supporting the industry. You know yourself, that, you know, the last 5 years since I've been back, you know, Brisbane's growing up a lot. Australia's a startup system's growing up a lot. So for me, what I try to do is bring marketing, professional marketing experience, and bring my 20 years and help founders. Because what I felt was happening was you'd have these founders who would be, say, great product guys or great tech guys, and they've got, you know, there's bespoke law firms out there for, you know, startups. There's accounting firms that specialize as investors, advisors, all these sort of people who do things, but there weren't marketers that specialized in startups. And that's not to say that it's that different. You know, the same principles apply. It's just a different way of packaging the deal up. So for me, my goal is help as many founders, give their business a chance, give that idea a chance to find their target audience. And so, you know, I kind of work on three different ways, I guess, with founders. If it's a really early stage idea, you know, my marketing is my personal brand marketing for me and Fractal is all about give away your time. Give whatever information. If people can ask you the right question, give them the right answer. Don't work in that restrictive supply model. And then as the business starts to get traction, they're trying to find product market fit and get their first customers, I'll typically then start to engage commercially. But I often with those companies, I end up working with a combination of sort of cash and safe notes and the ratio changes. But I ultimately still charge the company an invoice or send them an invoice for my time. So we know, you know, there's a commercial deal being done. It's just that for some of those companies, they'll pay off my time with a safe note, which is the Y Combinator version of a convertible note. And so the idea is it's not debt held against the company. It's just upside for me. And I find, and then as the company becomes more successful, then you know, they're more likely to pay me money. And usually like post angel round. And that's actually when I become often the most valuable because you get investors. I find it kind of ironic, right? So investors push founders really, really hard and then they drop $500,000 in to scale up the business, but without a marketing person. And so you've got a founder who's maybe a programmer who's now learning SEO and paid search and affiliate marketing, referral marketing as they go. And yet what investor would put money into a company, put his $500,000, oh, and I'm going to learn to program, you know, with your $500,000. Yet for marketing, for some reason, investors feel like it's something you can just give to anyone and they'll just, oh, we'll work it out. I'll just do some Facebook marketing. You're like, actually, there's a little bit more to our discipline of marketing than maybe just boosting a post. So
I find it even just more disturbing is that the startups that do employ marketing people then don't listen to them. And then make decisions based on what the technical guys are telling them as opposed to what the marketing people are telling them. And I'm not suggesting that marketing is the be-all and end-all of always getting things right, but to consistently discount the marketing advice is not necessarily suicidal, but it just makes it makes it a lot harder to potentially, you know, create revenue later on down the line.
Yeah, it's like you know, coaching in sports and everyone, you know, every fan is an expert. So you see on the side, you can see what it is, or it's like art. Everyone can be an expert in art, or, you know, they've got their own opinions. And it's really hard because you can spot the difference between a really great marketer and someone who just has a few things. And it's that ability to sort of create marketing empathy, get outside of your own head and go, well, that's what I would do. And go, well, what would other people do? How are they going to react to it? And that, you know, apart from all the academic discipline and the years and years of learnt lessons of how to do things and how to write copy and sales, et cetera, but just that basic essence. And so it can be really hard because a non-marketer, a non-professional marketer will just see the world through their eyes and they will not be able to see what you're trying to explain to them. Hugely frustrating, but that's the challenge, right? On the upside, the difference with working with founders is a founder actually does want to hear. So a business owner or a founder, you know, if it's their money that they're spending, they want to hear if their marketing is not working, as opposed to a corporate salaried person who's sort of sitting, you know, mid-tier, they actually don't want to hear that the marketing they're doing is not working. They want to hear that it is working. And therefore they're quite happy to pay you if you can sugarcoat what they're doing, you know, make it look good, make them protect their job. And that's the bit I like. I like the fact that a founder's going to sit there and say, is this working or not? Because if it's not working, then stop spending my money. You know, that's the one thing I've got that'll mean they'll probably try to listen to me.
Look, we'll have to wind this up. I've got three more questions for you. My usual three final questions. What are some brands that you like? What are things that you sort of aspire to and enjoy or buy all the time?
I'm a massive fan of a shoe company called Allbirds. So it's Allbirds, and they make they use New Zealand wool. The advertising though, like the shoe industry is so locked in, it's almost corrupted. These guys are breaking it down. It's one founder's a Kiwi guy, but their ads are great. Their social media is great. You can see the vision. You can see the mission of what they're doing. I'm wearing them now. They're kind of like street ready UGG boots, but they're machine washable, but their branding is just good. You know, they're lighthearted. They're like a MailChimp brand for shoes. I love what they're doing and I love that they're sticking it to the big companies.
Yeah. What about, so my second to last question then is, what's next for you? What is sort of the rest of 2018 hold and then beyond?
Yeah, so I'm just finishing my first year as Fractal. And for me, the first year was all about working out how to make the model work. Next year for me is going to be about expanding Fractal to tap into marcoms professionals that work outside of the startup industry and bring them in the same model that I'm working. So, you know, a head of a massive creative agency who actually hasn't done anything creative for the last 3 or 4 years and say, do you know what? I've got a startup company here. Why don't you give them 10, 20 hours of your time? Take a safe note. It might work. But the thing is, they get to do an innovative product. They get listened to. And look, they're probably on Bitcoin anyway, right? So they're probably making $200,000-$300,000. But so what they want is actually some way to make that money without having to pay more tax on it. And I think if I can create a network of people who believe in the idea of Fractal, the idea of helping startups, putting a bit of skin in the game, and maybe taking a bit of an investment, then my idea is to expand across Australia so that a startup can come to me or Fractal and say, hey, I need PR, I need marketing, I need branding, I want to do out of home, who can I speak to? And there's a whole bunch of people like us who go, yeah, I'll put some skin in the game and I'll help you out.
Brilliant. Last question. If people want to get hold of you, what's the best places, ways of getting hold of you?
Yeah, LinkedIn is my social network of choice at the moment. So I'm just Gerard Doyle on that. Twitter, I'm Gerbot, so G-E-R-B-O-T. Or you can just email me directly at Gerard, G-E-R-A-R-D, at fractal.com.au. I pretty much will speak to anybody.
So Gerbot is not actually a bot if people find you on Twitter.
That is a result of me. Remember right at the beginning, I said, I used to think, what would I do if I was Google? I said that so many times in one company, they stopped talking about Googlebot and start saying, yeah, okay, so Gerbot would do this. And so I just adopted that and it became a thing, but it's not actually a bot, although I probably should put something on there.
There should be, maybe that's the next business venture is everyone can have their own Gerbot in their home. You know, maybe you can have your own pod, Gerpod.
Oh, I think it'd be very scary to give a marketer. This is where things go wrong with data, right? You give a marketer access to all that kind of data. I don't think we always do the right things. So.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Anyway, mate, thank you very much for being on the show today. It's been, I know we could have spoken about 1,000 things for another three hours, but it's been really informative and I hope people out there have found it useful. So thank you very much for your time.
Fantastic. It was great being here. And I look forward to listening to this and obviously my own podcast, but all the other ones coming in the future from you. They're great. Keep it going.
No worries. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Thank you very much for tuning in. That was episode 31. It has been fantastic having you. Please come back again next week. And we appreciate you listening in. So thank you very much for tuning in to The Simon Dale Show.